Hi, I suggest that we get started. I have a very important job here. That is to get the mic on. Ironically, my important job is to tell you to turn off your cell phones so it's not picked up by the mics. So thank you. We'll do that. Airplane mode, please. So the other kind of job we have up here is to kind of moderate the power of pull. You have the panel, and you have the soccer game outside. So let's see which of these powers of pull actually do work. I knew my job. I'll sit down now. This would be an easy job. So today's... do you want to repeat what the score?
3-2 Germany.
Okay.
Third place.
Okay. So anyways, today's panel is on the power of pull. Jim Fellows will be doing the moderator. I can't believe anybody in this room needs to have Jim introduced. I think of you as being co-extensive with the Aspen Idea Festival. Now, John, on the other hand, my colleague, John is used to be the managing director at McKinsey and was actually the founder of their e-commerce practice, and then left there, did some other things, and is now the founder and co-chairman of the Center for the Edge. That paradoxical term is meant, the Center for the Edge at Deloitte. Turn it over.
Okay. Thank you very much, John. Thank you all for coming, especially after the soccer game and on this rainy afternoon. I think this should be a really interesting session. I am, from John Hagel's point of view, I think I am the ideal customer for his book, reader for his book, because I now have bought 3 copies. I have some for 2 different kinds of mobile devices and 1 hard copy, so I can be able to read it in all venues. And so if I suggest this as an example to all of you. You don't have to buy 3 copies, but one would serve you well. I found it really interesting to read, and I think this should be a great conversation. My plan is to ask John about the story of his book and his worldview and the implications for business and public life and individuals for about half the total time we have here. And then I'll try to involve all of you for things you wish he said in the book, things you don't know whether he said in the book, things you would like to apply in your life. So that's the prospect. And I'd like to start, in my experience as a book writer and a book reader, there is a story of every book in terms of a problem you're trying to solve. You know, the only write a book, writing a book is so unpleasant and so difficult that unless you feel that you have to do it, you will naturally give up along the way. So what was the problem you were trying to solve with this book? Tell us the story of the book as a book and as an intellectual exercise for you.
Okay, well, at one level, I can go way back, actually, to third grade. The genesis of the book was I was in third grade, and I was almost expelled from third grade because I was forging notes from my mother saying that I had to go to doctor's appointments. And instead, I was in Caracas, Venezuela at the time, and I was exploring the hinterlands of Caracas. And it was my early exposure to a world of push, where basically you're pre-programmed, everything you experience is pre-programmed and anticipated in advance, and I couldn't stand the world of push. So if I have to go back and psychoanalyze, that's probably the origins of the book. More recently, about 15 years ago, I guess, at this point, I met a guy by the name of John Seely Brown, and we came at business issues from very different dimensions. JSB, for those of you who know him, is one of the top technologists in the world. I have no technology background whatsoever, liberal arts all the way. But the two of us really hit it off because we were concerned about similar kinds of issues. And in particular, we were concerned in a social context about the impact of technology on relationships and how those relationships are evolving as a result of technology. And then on a broader scale, the impact of technology on business and the kinds of challenges it's creating. And if there's a problem that we would cite that was kind of the catalyst specifically for the book, it was an analysis we did about 18 months ago where we asked what we thought was a fairly simple question, but to our surprise, apparently had never been asked and certainly never answered. And it was just the question of how are we doing in the United States in terms of corporate performance? And to measure that performance, we basically took return on assets. Now, there are a lot of issues you can have with that particular measure, but it's a reasonable one to look at the total returns on the assets that are deployed in a business, profitability trends over time. And we decided we were going to look at it over a long period of time. We went back to 1965, and we looked at it for all public companies in the United States, not a sample, but every single public company. We said, how have companies done over that time period? Well, it turns out the return on assets has collapsed over that time period. It's gone down by 75%. It's been a steady, sustained erosion. There is absolutely no sign of it leveling off, much less turning back around. And so it really focused our attention to say, wait a minute, what's going on here? Why is this happening? And what can we do about it? And so that was really kind of the focusing event or fact for the book that got us to really pull together essentially 3 years' worth of research that we've been doing at the Center for the Edge to try to answer that question. But it really raises a question. I think it's particularly ironic at a time, I've been to many sessions around Aspen over the past week where the big debate is the economic recovery. Are we in the recovery? How long is it going to last? How fast is it going to be? Nobody has raised this broader, more sustained issue of long-term erosion and profitability. What about that? There is no recovery in the sense of going back to normal. There is no sense at all that this erosion in profitability is turning around. So what are we going to do about that? That's the question for the book.
I'm going to come back to that question in a moment. I'd like to, as an introductory process, have you explain more about the concept of pull. What exactly you mean, not simply in distinguishing it from push, right, but also in distinguishing it from other things we've heard over the last decade or two, whether it's lean manufacturing or any other proxy for agility, which yeah. is so tell us how we should think of pull.
It's a great question because we face the debate, do we adopt a new label for what we're talking about, which has all the problems of trying to get people used to a new label, or do we take a label that we all know but has a lot of baggage to it? We ended up choosing the latter and picking pull as kind of the organizing theme on the side of what do we do about this? How do we turn this thing around? And what we mean by pull is essentially the notion of being able to draw out people and resources when we need them, where we need them, creating scalable platforms where we can do this not just with a few partners, but with tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, even millions of participants on these pull platforms. So scalability is a big issue, and it is a big contrast with what is known in the business world as pull lean manufacturing systems. Those typically work. The Toyota kind of model works if you have a very limited number of strategic partners, get them tightly integrated into your operations, then you can pull your inventory out through the supply chain. But we're looking at scalable pull where you can do this across many, many different participants because increasingly we no longer know who we are going to need the resources from. And so that scalability is a key issue. The other piece that I think is important is many people talk about pull in the sense of just, okay, I understand there's lots of people and resources out there. How do I connect to them, pull them into my operations or my life? And in that context, that's important. That's probably what we would call the first level of pull, which is access. It's just being able, it's the classic example is Google. You have a question, you go out, you ask the question, and within seconds you've got answers or information that will help you get the answer. That's interesting, but the more interesting parts of pull have to do with a second level, which we call attraction. And it has to do with the notion that increasingly in this rapidly changing world, we no longer even know what question to ask or who to look for. So how do you can't use search to do that. And in that kind of context, it's a question of attracting people in unexpected ways to you that turn out, we've all had that reaction. We run into somebody and we say, oh my God, that person was so interesting. They're working on something very similar to what I'm working on, gave me some new insight. That's what we're talking about in that second level. And then there's a third level of pull, which has to do with the notion of pulling out of each of us as individuals and institutions our full potential. So it gets into the notion of performance improvement and learning as the key goal in that third level of pull. And to us, that's the most interesting level of pull, ultimately.
And what's the bottom line? The bottom line is that we're in the middle of a big shift that is forcing us from a world of push into this world of pull, and that there's a huge opportunity if you harness these techniques to actually create a very interesting increasing returns to business. That's the bottom line.
Could tell us a current business example, business or life example, that best fits this model and that least fits this model, just again of sort of outlining and clarifying exactly what you're talking about.
The best fits the model is much more challenging than the doesn't fit the model. Virtually every corporation today does not fit the model. Virtually every corporation today was built on a model of push, where you have detailed forecasts and you organize all the resources and people to make sure they're in the right place at the right time. The companies that are actually pioneering these new pull approaches, one of the more challenging assertions in our book is that most of the innovation in the world today is occurring in China and India, not here in the United States. So the companies that we look at in the book are mainly Chinese companies and Indian companies who have created scalable networks on a global basis, thousands of participants, in some cases tens of thousands of participants, that are pulling very specialized resources into very complex processes over time. A classic example for a specific name is Lianfeng in China. In the apparel industry, not very well known here in the United States. I give the example of if you go into any shopping center in the United States, walk through all the stores in that shopping center, look at all the apparel in that shopping center. Roughly 40% of the apparel in all those stores was sourced through a Lianfeng network. So extremely important in the apparel industry, a $15 billion company, yet virtually nobody here in the United States has ever heard of them, much less understands the power of what they're doing in terms of innovating around the institutions that they're creating on a global basis.
And again, to remind you of the plan here, I'm going to take John through some questions I actually know the answers to, having read his book. But in case all of you haven't read it, I'm going to give him a chance to explain. And again, to a very, very important concept in your book is the stock versus flow concept. Can you explain that and why that's so fundamental to your analysis?
No, one of the challenges for us, because we believe we are going through a very complex big shift that's been playing out over decades and will continue to play out. There are many different dimensions to that big shift. So one of the challenges is how do you condense it down to the soundbite. One way of condensing it down to the soundbite is we are moving from a world of stocks to flows. What do we mean by that? What we mean is that in business in particular, although it applies in education, it applies in all kinds of nonprofit and government institutions, we built our institutions around the fundamental assumption that the center of value creation is in knowledge stocks, what you know at any point in time, your ability to keep those knowledge stocks proprietary, because that is your differentiation. God forbid anybody else should get access to it. And then to as efficiently as possible extract the value from that knowledge stock. Now, the challenge we face in this big shift is that in a world of increasing change and uncertainty, our knowledge stocks are depreciating at an accelerating rate, with the possible exception of Coca-Cola's formula for their famous soft drink. Most of us face the challenge that whatever we know today is of diminishing value. So unless we can find ways to participate in a very large number of diverse knowledge flows that will refresh our knowledge stocks, allow us to learn faster, drive our performance more rapidly, we basically are going to be increasingly marginalized in this world. And I cannot emphasize enough that our belief is the institutions and practices that we have all been brought up in the institutions that we have today, is around knowledge stocks. And it is a huge transition to go to knowledge flows as a source of value. And our belief is that's, I tell you the number of times I talk to people in large companies or small companies, in leaders of corporations and institutions who talk about the growing stress they're feeling. And part of the message in this book, it's not necessarily a good news message, but the message is that stress is real. It's not in your mind. It's actually happening. And the stress is because you are continuing to act and engage in institutions that were built for a different world. And you're still trying to create value with those practices and institutions, and it's getting harder and harder. So the only way to overcome that stress is to step back at a fundamental level and say, what do we need to really do differently in order to create value in a less stressful way?
Again, to clarify the argument for those who haven't read your book, what's an illustration of an institution that is relying most on the old stock knowledge approach and one that's relying most on the flow knowledge approach, the best and worst examples to show what you're thinking?
Probably the classic example is in terms of knowledge stocks would be the pharma industry. But I hesitate to name an industry because the media industry is all about knowledge stocks.
We're changing.
Financial services is all about knowledge stocks. It's all about having proprietary knowledge, proprietary products that nobody else has access to, and being able to leverage the value from it. But certainly in pharma, the patent protection around major new drug discoveries and vigorously protecting those patents against any competition is probably the most extreme example of a knowledge stock business. And then on the other side, you have a variety of companies. I don't think there's any particular industry. If I were forced to kind of highlight one, I would probably talk about the tech industry just because it's been under such intense competitive pressure for so long, and at least has started to think about broader networks of partners to involve in their activities, although I would argue that the kind of relationships they've built are not really trust-based relationships. It's much more a transactional set of connections, and that's not what's required to really participate in flows of knowledge.
Now, you're not really suggesting, I don't think, a black and white change in the way things operate. I mean, there's always been pre-planning. There's always been improvisation.
Right.
You're saying that the proportions are different now, right?
Yeah, it is a spectrum. Clearly, everything we do has a component of push, a component of pull. Over time, our belief is that we're going to have to move down that spectrum to a much more focus on pull mechanisms, but there still will be some elements of push in the world, for sure.
Right. And we had a few moments ago an admirably direct question from the audience, which if this were a 10-minute panel, I would have led off with. So, I'm going to have you highlight the so what does one do differently concept of your book. Talk about the corporate level, but also the individual level, and this concept of prepared serendipity you have too.
Yeah, it's one of the challenges we had in writing the book, and I think we're beginning to see the results of it, is it ultimately spoke to business people. It's categorized as a business book, but we tried to write the book as speaking to all of us in our individual lives, because we believe all these techniques, all these challenges and opportunities are as much available to us as individuals as institutions and firms that we operate in. So we are trying to address both sets of needs. We talk about some what we think are pretty interesting stories of people and institutions that are mastering the techniques of pull. But some of these stories are about individuals. They're not part of larger firms. They're not even involved in business activities in any conventional sense. So it is one of the key notions in the book is in terms of personal practices and institutional practices, gets to that second level of pull, of attraction. Now, when we talk about attraction, the word serendipity very naturally comes up. The problem with that word is the baggage around that word, which is most of us, when we talk about serendipity, talk about it in terms of pure luck. You know, it happens when it happens. The best thing you can do, as Louis Pasteur said, is be prepared for it when it does happen. But, you know, it is luck. There's nothing you can do about it. We take a more provocative view and say that, in fact, there are significant opportunities to shape serendipity, not make it fully predictable, but increase the probability and the quality of the unexpected encounters you're going to run into. So one example of that that gets to a debate that's been held for many years now at the Aspen Institute around a very sharp observer and analyst, Tom Friedman, who has written a very eloquent book called The World is Flat, and makes a compelling case that location no longer matters. Wherever you are in the world, you just plug into this infrastructure, and it's as good as being anywhere else. There's another person who spoke earlier this week, some of you may have heard him, by the name of Richard Florida. He is equally compelling around the view that actually the world is getting increasingly spiky. that we are moving with increasing rapidity into large geographic concentrations of population. Now, why would that be? If the world is flat, location no longer matters, why would we ever move? There's a paradox there. One answer, and I don't want to oversimplify, there are a lot of reasons that this is going on, but we believe one of the reasons it's going on is because we intuitively understand that if we are in a large concentration of population, particularly a population that is engaged around the kinds of things that we have interests and passions around, we are much more likely to have a serendipitous encounter in that geographic spike than if we were sitting out on a farm in some rural area. So there is, and if you believe that serendipitous encounter is increasingly valuable because we no longer know what to look for when we plug into this infrastructure, that becomes increasingly important, and that's part of the reason we are moving with increasing frequency into large urban concentrations. So you can make choices about where to spend your time, these spikes versus elsewhere. It could also be the kinds of conferences you go to. Where do you spend your time? How many conferences do you go to?
You all made just the right choice today.
Right? Absolutely. What kinds of conferences do you go to? In virtual space, where do you spend your time on the internet? Are you in social networks where there's an opportunity for serendipitous encounters? So choices about where you spend your time and then how you spend your time. Once you're in these places where there's a high likelihood of serendipitous encounters, the challenge is that actually those are large concentrations of people. So how do you rise up and be an attraction, have a beacon, as actually Jack Hittery, I think, is in the audience. We wrote about him as a classic beacon to attract people to him based on the practices, the actions he takes wherever he goes.
So, and just to ascertain one fact issue here, on the spiky versus flat spectrum, where do you place yourself?
I live in Silicon Valley, so I have to I have to say. I am a big believer. I think at the end of the day, like most paradoxes, you resolve it by saying there's elements of truth in both, right?
Yeah, but one or the other.
So. One or the other. Spikes. If you're going to be anywhere, be in a spike.
Yes.
Figure out what spike
and so
is
actually,
most relevant.
So actually, I will pull collective wisdom here. If taking the two extremes, being forced to one or the other, location doesn't really matter in the flat world, location really does matter. Who thinks location really does matter? Who thinks location really doesn't matter? My somewhat flip answer on this is the world looks flat if you're just in international airports. You get outside the airport, it looks pretty different. So to sort of wrap up the description of your argument, Case, what is the, people have heard about the trade-off between preparation and innovation for a long time. They've heard about lean manufacturing. They've heard about serendipity. What is the distillation of the newest argument that if people read your book, they will then carry themselves differently, having understood this?
Well, I think probably the most provocative, and I will say the most speculative part of our book, is to take, again, some conventional wisdom in the business world, which for those of you who are familiar with consulting, I actually started my career many, many years ago with a firm called Boston Consulting Group. They had one chart that basically drove the success of the firm, and it was called the experience curve. And it was a very, very accurate way of showing how performance evolves in industry after industry. They started it in the semiconductor industry. They've applied it to everything from toilet paper to Japanese beer. The experience curve holds. And the key challenge with the experience curve, even though it's extraordinarily accurate, is it's a diminishing returns curve. The more experience you accumulate in a market or industry, the longer you have to wait for that next increment of performance improvement. That's part of the reason we're feeling more and more stress. In a diminishing returns world, that's highly stressful. We have a belief, looking at some rather interesting domains that are quite diverse, that we, for the first time, have an opportunity through a combination of technology platforms and practices to turn that experience curve on its side and create an increasing returns curve, where the more people who participate in a particular arena, the faster everybody's going to learn and improve performance. That's a huge upside. We think it applies to people as individuals, and it applies to firms. And increasingly, if you're not participating in what we call these creation spaces, you will, in fact, be left farther and farther behind.
And so, again, to push on that point at a personal level.
Pull on that point.
Yeah, sorry. Pull on that point. Yes, to pull on that point. At the personal level, you do talk a fair amount in the book about things you think people having read this will then do differently in their personal lives. Just mention a few of these, if you would.
Well, one of the things, and it's a bit of a provocative message most executives, when I talk about it, kind of crook their head back and forth to try to figure out why am I saying this? We put a lot of emphasis in the book on the necessity of connecting your passion with your profession. Historically, until quite recently at least, most generations were brought into the workforce with the belief that you went to work to earn a paycheck so that you could pursue your passion outside of work. But don't dare bring that passion inside work. It's not predictable. Passion is hugely unpredictable, and it's disruptive. So a key part of our advice is find your passion, and wherever and however possible, make that your profession. If you don't, and so when executives hear me talk about this and they find out I'm from California, they say, oh, one of these new age types, you know, passion is potential and all that. The way we came at this was by looking at where do you see sustained extreme performance improvement? What arenas do you see that kind of phenomenon occurring? And I will tell you, everyone that we've looked at, one of the common elements, it's not the only one, but one of the common elements is the participants have deep passion about performance. They are looking to drive their performance ever forward to new levels. So if you believe, as we do, that we are in a world of increasing pressure, if you don't have that kind of passion about performance improvement, you're going to be increasingly sidelined.
I have two or three more questions I want to ask John. I'm going to turn the microphones over to you. But I want to now pursue this passion about performance. An audience like the audience here has a fair amount of choice about the professions that he or she chooses to pursue. For a lot of people in the United States and around the world, that is not so much an option. In my observations of the world, there's an experience when flying frequently between Japan and China. When you're in Japan, the people handling the baggage are bowing, and the bus attendants are bowing you off, and you do everything. And you get to the Chinese airport, and the baggage attendants are playing tag, and they're throwing bags at each other. And there is a passion for performance at all levels of Japanese society as part of what makes Japan unusual. China still works without so much of that being evident in the working ranks of China. How does your message apply in the United States for the sizable fraction of people who don't have a lot of choice about the profession right. they pursue?
Well, part of it has to do... So there are passions, by the way, that even very unskilled people can explore and develop as a profession. I know actually a lot of garage mechanics who are deeply passionate about their work. They love working with cars, and that's their thrill, and they're constantly trying to push their performance. I think that one of the examples that we use in the book, and it goes back to Japan, is Toyota in terms of the conventional wisdom in Detroit was that you could, give me a break. Passion, yeah, if you're a software engineer or if you're some kind of quant on Wall Street, maybe you can be passionate. But if you're a manual laborer working on an assembly line, doing routine operations, how could you ever get passionate about that kind of experience? What Toyota did was to redefine that work and say, yes, you're going to have to do some routine activities as you operate the assembly line, but actually your primary job is to identify problems, because problems continually arise on this assembly line, not only to identify the problems, but then to tackle those problems and to come up with creative solutions to those problems. And by the way, we're going to make the rest of the company organize it to support you in that task. And remarkably, passion went extremely way up on the assembly line. Now, the first order response defense from Detroit was, give me a break. That's Japan. That's their cultural heritage. They can get passionate about these kinds of things. American workers are never going to do that. So Toyota comes into the United States and builds plants here in the United States, adopts the same practices. Guess what? Passion goes way up. So we do believe that there's an opportunity for institutions and institutional leaders to redefine the workspace in ways that emphasize much more the creative problem solving at all levels of the organization. Creative problem solving can be done by a receptionist sitting at the front desk at the entry to the offices. It can be done by the lowest clerical worker. It can be done by an assembly line worker. But it does require the senior leadership of the institution to redefine that workspace in ways that help to draw out that passion. Failing that, I think our advice is you need to find institutions or workspaces where you can develop that passion. One of the things we'll say is that we did, as part of the background research for this book, something that we call the Shift Index. That ROA trend that I mentioned earlier was one element, one of 25 metrics in the Shift Index. Another metric had to do with levels of passion in the workforce in the United States. And by the way, I will say, when we talk about passion, we don't mean happiness or satisfaction. Most executives, when you do that, say, oh, you're talking about the happy workers. No. Actually, some of the passionate workers are some of the most dissatisfied workers, right? They see all the opportunities, and they see all those obstacles that have been put in front of them that prevent them from achieving those new levels of performance. So deeply frustrated people, but deeply passionate about the work they do. Passion is inversely related in the U.S. workforce to the size of the company. The bigger the company, the less passion there is. The most passionate workers in the United States are those who are self-employed. And we believe, even though we don't have the trend data to support it, our hypothesis is there has been a flight of passion from the institutions that we have today, because the institutions are not organized to support passionate engagement with the work.
You know, an interesting exception illustrating the rule is probably the uniform military, which is very large.
Yes.
And this has as one of its main emphases trying to inculcate passionate levels. I have a political question for you, and I have then a literary question. Then it is audience question time. Political question is this. I was at a session this morning where Dr. Barat of Daimler Mercedes was saying, just as an offhand observation, something that was quite arresting. He was talking about how corporations around the world, including the U.S., were just as innovative, you know, there as any place else. But he said, what I see in the U.S. is the people in brain work are being able to rise, but there are people doing services that are not very well paid and aren't going to be well paid, and the middle has gone away. He said, in Europe, we still have the middle because our manufacturing is still competitive. So we have rich people, we have services, but we have that middle level, which he says, I think, has vanished here. If you were applying number one, how do you react to that in very similar analyses we've heard from Andy Grove and others about the social crisis of American capitalism, of the vanishing middle? When you were saying earlier the ROA was descending, I was thinking, I've heard this from Marx and Engels before. So it's not just from lean manufacturing people.
Oh, my God. So
what is your diagnosis for?
My name
is
Hegel.
That's right. For the political crisis of American capitalism, how does your diagnosis apply to it? Political crisis meaning the vanishing middle.
That's a whole other book, which may be a sequel to this one. I think that the short form answer is, I've read Andy Grove's article, and a lot of his message, I think there is a disappearing middle that is a problem. His answer is, how do you bring back manufacturing and adopt essentially a new industrial policy that will protect manufacturing in the United States and not slow down at least the movement of jobs offshore? I don't believe that's the answer. I believe flows rule, and anything that tries to adopt a protectionist frame around our economic activity is going to come back and bite us in terms of our ability to improve performance more rapidly. I would say the answer to the political crisis is to reframe all our public policy debates around a new lens. It's essentially to say, for whatever public policy issue is on the table, what is its impact on talent development? And when I say that, the natural reaction of a lot of people is to say, oh, you're talking about educational policy. Yes, our educational system's in crisis. No, I'm not talking about educational policy. You know, it's certainly part of it. It's a diminishing part of it, in my belief. The key to talent development is everything else. It goes to immigration issues. It goes to intellectual property protection. It goes to financial regulation. It goes to trade policy. what is the impact of any option that's on the table in terms of our ability to accelerate talent development of our people, and which policy options are going to slow down that talent development? Because the answer ought to be, we ought to be picking the policies that allow us to develop our talent more rapidly than anybody else in the world. And until we do that, I think we're in deep trouble.
And this will substitute for audience applause in that point. I'll ask a clarifying question. On immigration policy in particular, how do you rationalize the two very disparate issues of low-skilled immigration, mainly on the southern border, and high-skilled immigration of the U.S. as talent magnet? How do we simultaneously solve controlling the one and encouraging the other?
I want to encourage it all. Yeah. Immigration historically has brought people to the United States who want to improve their performance, want to improve their life. They take enormous risks. They leave their families. They leave their homes in order to come here to be better. I want more of those people in our borders.
So how many people here were born outside the U.S.? Born outside the U.S. That's impressive. So here's my final question, a literary personal one. You will be the first author on Earth if there's nothing in this book. If you don't have something in this book that you wish you phrased differently or have had some pentimenti about, you'll be the only author ever. What do you wish you had phrased a little bit differently, or what have you learned since the book has come out that you would like to add if you're writing again today?
Wow. The list is long. I think we tried to strike this balance between the individual and the firm and the corporation. And I think we're increasingly of the belief that we actually did accomplish that. But one of the byproducts of it, which I think we could have done a better job of clarifying, is many people read our book and take the simple takeaway that we're talking about the individual is the power, the firm no longer matters, and there's a whole school of thought in the digital world that we're moving to a world where corporations no longer exist. It's all about independent contractors and entrepreneurs who connect with each other, but there's no need for a larger institution. We do not hold that view. We believe that institutions are absolutely essential. If you take talent development as a key priority, institutions properly organized and properly focused can be huge amplifiers of talent development. The problem is we've got institutions that were organized for a different purpose, and the people with passion seeking talent development are fleeing those institutions. I think that's a transition problem. I don't think that's a permanent trend. And so I do think that that's one message that did get, could have been sharper in the book.
That's what the second edition is for.
Yes.
And the sequel. So Absolutely. Who would like to ask a question? So yes, Eric, would you identify yourself for those who don't know you and ask the question? Yes.
Eric Bonobo. I just would like to have your reaction to the following way of reconciling the spiky and flat thing. I think flat is for left brain stuff, and spiky is for right brain stuff. I mean, think about it, right? Anything that can be automated, that can be formalized almost into a mathematical formula, it doesn't matter where you are. But things that have to do with, creativity and interactions with other people and warmth and stuff like that, you need to be, So what do you think?
It's an interesting distinction, and I think does have some application. I do think the other element, though, is one of my beliefs around why spikes are becoming more prominent as opposed to less prominent is because in the past, if you went to a spike, you were isolated from everything else. You were really making a choice to just be in that spike.
So how do you mean? What was an example of that?
Oh, somebody moving across country to come to San Francisco to, mine gold or whatever. They were there. They had made their commitment. Yeah. What now is feasible, and we're seeing emerging in many different industries, is the opportunity to connect spikes in very powerful ways around the world. So Bangalore, I would argue, could never have emerged in the way it has without the ability to connect to Silicon Valley, another spike.
But the connection is left-brain connection.
Oh, I don't believe that's the case. I think that's the way Bangalore started. I believe Bangalore today is more and more right-brain.
The nation connection is very...
Even there, I mean, I, even there, I think there's a lot of air travel between Bangalore and Silicon Valley that has nothing to do with routine kinds of activities, but has to do with deep problem solving that's very right brain oriented. I wouldn't just want to automatically say everything's right brain that's in a spike and the rest is left brain.
But an interesting construct.
Yes, yes.
Yes.
In thinking about this difference between knowledge stocks and knowledge flows and trying to understand that, the first U.S. company that came into my mind was Jigsaw, which is probably a company you're familiar with, but they aggregate business contact information. One of the things the CEO, Jim Fowler, realized was that the value wasn't in having such a collection. The value was in the updates and keeping it all the time current and fresh. And so my understanding is that he crowdsourced that to some significant extent and then became an aggregator and was successful enough that Dun & Bradstreet, who is the incumbent, instead of trying to squash them, actually did a deal with them. And I wondered if you felt that was a good example in the U.S.
I think it's an interesting example, but it gives me an opportunity to clarify in terms of knowledge flows, because I think particularly coming from Silicon Valley, when I talk about knowledge flows, immediately people go to large databases that are going through the internet across the world, and that's a knowledge flow. It is a knowledge flow of one type. But our belief is the most important knowledge flows are what we would call tacit knowledge. It's the knowledge that we have in our heads based on new experiences that we've encountered that we can't express even to ourselves, much less to other people. And it's very hard to get that kind of knowledge to flow unless you create long-term trust-based relationships among people so that they feel comfortable engaging with each other around knowledge that they're going to stumble to even express in a group session. So that's, in our minds, the most valuable knowledge flow. In a time of rapid change, by the time it's in a document or in a database and highly quantified, it's probably too late. The most valuable knowledge in a time of rapid change is that tacit knowledge based on very new experiences. It's one of the reasons we come to conferences, frankly. I mean, in the tech industry, we have a metric now that says you can measure the activity around new technology generations based on the level of conference activity. Something that's really, really new, you get a ton of conferences around. Why? Because people, again, instinctively understand they're coming together to tell stories to each other. They're not showing large databases of trends and patterns. They're saying, you know, I went through this experience with this technology and I ran into this problem. I'm not sure what it is. And, you know, I'm having a hard time even expressing what I learned from it. And so there's this really valuable exchange of tacit knowledge that starts to emerge even at that level. And so that to us is the real power of flow, of knowledge flows, is figuring out how to tap into those kinds of that kind of knowledge, tacit knowledge, not to diminish, again, the value of information and data being able to be more easily exchanged. But
and say one thing more just before calling on you for a question. The point about the Jigsaw model is very relevant to my business of the media, because on the one hand, the only product we have is information flow. I mean, it's news, that's by definition, that's what the news is. But our business structure for the last couple of decades has been sort of artificially stable and has become static now. Yeah. So we're going through dynamism, to put it mildly, in our structure. Yes.
Thank you. My name is Paul Anderson. I'm a columnist at the Aspen Times. 2 days ago in the music tent, Bill Gates said that the most important import for the U.S. is IQ. I'm just wondering if about the drain of IQ on nations that may desperately need them and in order to pursue their own advance.
And I have an answer on that after yours.
I do not in any way want to diminish the importance of IQ around the world. I do believe it's the responsibility of every country to figure out ways to attract and retain and develop the people with IQ. I believe that a lot of the reason people with IQ are migrating or trying to migrate, increasingly not able to migrate, to the United States is because they believe they can develop their practices, their insights much more rapidly here than elsewhere. And I do think it becomes a hopefully, a pressure point on countries around the world to reassess their policies, to say, what are we doing that is making it more difficult? I would argue in most of the emerging countries in the world, there's much more opportunity to increase your insight and your practices in those worlds. Why isn't it not serving as a magnet? I think a lot of it has to do with public policy that is discouraging that kind of performance improvement in those countries.
My condensed answer, since I'm just the moderator rather than the guest, is that I've seen a lot of countries around the world where an apparent brain drain is a symptom of a problem. For example, the Philippines, where you have a huge diaspora of very, very talented Filipinos who are working in the Gulf and the U.S. and all over in China and other places. People say, why aren't they working in the Philippines? Same thing in much of Africa, where medical professionals leave. I think that's the symptom. The actual cause is the dysfunction in those countries, which makes it impossible for people to realize their ambitions there. And very, very notably in China, where I've been living, you see people who feel thwarted in some way from fulfilling their full ambition within China. It's still the fact that many, many ethnically Chinese people have won Nobel Prizes in the sciences, zero of them from Chinese institutions. They've all had to go other places to do this research. That's not the fault of Cambridge or Berkeley or Harvard. It's the fault of the institutions in China, and that's now being redressed. I think that it's if there's a brain drain, it's a problem to be addressed in the home country, not here. Let's see. Yes, over here.
There's one issue you haven't addressed at all, and that's the old classic debt financing concept of how entrepreneurial companies would start, whether it was a base of equity of billions or a base of equity of $100,000. It seems to me that a lot of the changes which you think are happening have got to be told to the financial institutions of this country. They're the ones who have to cooperate. The old idea of an asset-based loan apparently is diminishing because the base of the, as you said, the asset bases are diminishing, and they're no longer necessarily a benchmark for financing. Also, cash flows. You used to be able to finance a company on a multiple of cash flow with very little asset base.
Yeah.
This is histories of companies that have been having that cash flow for years. Okay, in a bad year, it'd be off 10%. In a good year, it'd be up 10%.
Yes.
They didn't look at assets at that time, or they looked at them, but they only in a secondary way.
Yes.
How can we change to what you're expecting to change without the concept of financing? Now, we could do everything 100% on equity, because there's plenty of equity around.
Right.
But we never did that, because the equity players were always partners with the debt players.
Right.
How are we going to get the financing side of this up to where we need to be? Otherwise, the Chinese banks and the Japanese banks, the countries you're from, they're the ones who are going to take over because they're doing the financing that we're not doing, and they're not changing. The banks are still using the old concepts. How can we get them to help us with the old capitalistic ideas of advancement?
Yeah. It's a great question. I think that one of the challenges is we are talking about such fundamental changes across so many different areas of activity that one can easily get locked into a paralysis and say, without this, without that, we can't possibly move. I'll just tell a story in terms of my experience in China. I've been going to China since 1982 in a business context. And I started coming back with a lot of optimism about what's going on in China, not in the state-owned enterprises and the government, but in the entrepreneurial activity going on around the edge of China. And the response I got from American executives was, John, don't get carried away here. And this was about 10 or 15 years ago. Don't get carried away. You know, two things in China that are going to be insurmountable obstacles. One is they don't have a financial system that is designed to support entrepreneurial activity. So entrepreneurs are never going to get the financing and funding to get their business off the ground. And secondly, there's no IP protection. So if they come up with something innovative, they're going to get copied and the incentive for innovation is going to go away. I think what's interesting is what the Chinese entrepreneurs did as a response to that. They said, okay, facts of life. We don't have a financing system, a banking system, or a venture capital community that can support us. So we need to be absolutely ruthless about what are the things that only we can do. And that's all we're going to do. And if there's anybody else out there in the world that can do things that will amplify or support or be complementary to our activity, we're going to network out and connect to them. And that was the genesis of this whole rethinking of how do you create scalable business networks. So they turned what was a perceived to be an insurmountable obstacle into an incredible source of innovation. Secondly, they said, okay, we don't have IP protection. You know, as soon as we come up with something interesting, it's going to get copied. So we cannot afford to relax. If we come up with an innovation, that's just the next step. The next step is tomorrow, the day after, we need to start thinking about the next wave of innovation. And so this notion of rapid incremental innovation became central to their management practices in a way that I don't think most U.S. or Western companies have really adopted. And so I think the combination of these scalable global networks of relationships plus this focus on relentless incremental innovation is creating a really powerful set of new approaches to business.
But that was the end of the United States as the financial leader of the world. We're basically giving up now and saying we're part of a world economy and we'll be 17th in this and 14th in this, but we'll never be number one again. Is that where we're going?
I certainly hope not. Part of the goal of our book, the mission of our book, is as a wake-up call to say there is a problem here. We are way too complacent. We are way too focused on short-term events. All this discussion about economic recovery, that's great. It's understandable. But that is not the issue on the table. And nobody's talking about the issue on the table.
You've got to teach the financial institutions to get modern
in
this country.
We're working on it.
Yes.
Hi, I'm Derek Scruggs from Boulder, Colorado. You mentioned this megatrend of return on assets declining over the last 30-plus years, I think you mentioned. I was also in the morning session about innovation, and one of the things they mentioned in passing is that in Germany, for example, CEO pay is more like 20x the frontline workers versus 400x that we have here. So I wonder if you could just sort of comment. We have this mega trend of declining return on assets but increasing CEO pay. And based on news reports, the best job in America back in December 2009 was to work at Goldman Sachs, right? They were paying out some pretty nice bonuses there. They seem to be doing pretty well with that whole push philosophy, and I just wonder if you could comment on that.
This is your role as Hegel once again.
Right. You know, I think it's a tragedy that senior executives are getting paid so much money in a world where return on assets is declining over 40-plus years. How do you possibly explain that? So I'm not in any way a champion or proponent of that kind of disparity if the economic value is not being created. Now, I'm all in favor if somebody comes up with a world-changing innovation and reaps huge rewards for the employees and for the stakeholders and for customers, pay them extremely well. But in a world where we are facing declining return on assets, there is no way the compensation of senior executives should be going down consonant with the decline in return on assets. Maybe that will focus some attention on the real problem.
Yes, Bob.
Yeah. Hi, Bob Hormetz, State Department. I'd like to ask you to drill a little deeper on the China point, because I have a number of questions that relate to their actual innovation as opposed to their perceived innovation. That's the most delicate way I can put it. And that is, I have no doubt that in certain areas they're very innovative. Green technology, they're doing remarkable things, and we have been sleeping in a way while they're doing things. India also, for the same reasons.
Yes.
But let's focus on China. It is certainly true that they're innovative areas. It is also quite true that no country in the world engages to the degree China does in piracy of intellectual property, and in many ways, the reason they have these innovation networks is they force you, as a precondition for selling in China, to transfer technology to China, what they call indigenous innovation policy. It's not indigenous. It's not innovation. They force you, and they've suspended it, fortunately, for a variety of reasons. We've encouraged them to do this. But before this, they forced you, as a precondition for selling to the government, to either transfer the technology to a Chinese company, or the government can only buy it from a Chinese company and not from a foreign company. Now, they've said they're going to reconsider this. But and one of the reasons, one of the things that goes on more and more, as you know better than I, is there's a lot more internationalization of innovation. researchers in China or India working with researchers in Palo Alto or MIT. If you cannot be secure in the feeling that innovation is not going to be stolen the next day by the Chinese company you're working with without any protection under Chinese law, how are you going to participate in this networking that you're describing? So I concede the point there's innovation. I also think that there is a great deal going on in China because they're not able to innovate as well as they should be able to, right, taking it from others, pirating from others, forcing the transfer of technology.
Right.
If that's the case, and they do this successfully because they've got a big market, then a lot of American companies are innovating will find the fruits of their innovation undermined by the Chinese, and then it shows up as in the Cisco case, where the Chinese company competing with the very company that provided the innovation, having been taken from them and then used to compete against them. How do you deal with this issue, and how do you, over a period of time, you might argue the Chinese will be more responsible because they'll have their own IP, but they're not there yet, and they're far from it. India's a little bit better, but I'd like you to just dwell on the China thing for a moment.
No, it's a great question, and I just want to clarify, when I talk about China being innovative, I don't actually mean in a technology dimension or even a product dimension. They still, in most industries, are far behind the U.S. or Western countries in terms of that kind of innovation. The kind of innovation that I was referring to, and I think, again, it's a mark of Western executives. When we talk about innovation in the West, it's typically around product and technology, and it's typically the only interesting innovation is breakthrough innovation. If it's not breakthrough, if it's not the iPod, doesn't really engage or matter. Huge issues around intellectual property protection in terms of technology and product. I would say that the most important innovation, form of innovation that we all need to focus on is innovation at the institutional level. How do we redefine roles and relationships across large numbers of institutions so that we can deliver much more value in a sustainable way to the marketplace? I do think on that dimension, the companies that we've looked at, and we're not talking about the state-owned enterprises, the enterprises that come in as partners to Western companies when they have to do the deals with the Chinese government. We're talking about the entrepreneurs who have been largely ignored by the Chinese government, and they have, as I mentioned earlier, in response to really deep challenges that they had because they weren't getting a lot of support from the government, have come up with extraordinarily innovative institutional arrangements that allow them to scale these networks in a way that any Western company would just die from the complexity overhead. They could not handle it. Now, one of the reasons that they are able to scale these global networks is they have stumbled across, I don't think they came at this with full intention, they stumbled across a notion of organizing extended processes that cover many different enterprises in a much more modular, loosely coupled way. Rather than the Western approach, which is tightly specified, tightly integrated processes, they've created modular, loosely coupled processes. And one of the implications of that is you can modularize your product and process in a way where Western companies can choose and say, okay, these modules are particularly proprietary to us. We don't want to expose ourselves to that kind of piracy in China. We're going to hold those for ourselves. But these other modules that are less differentiating, we will go out into China and take advantage of these business networks, these process networks, to create more value for our customers. So I think that that's an important clarification. I don't in any way want to be saying that the Chinese are at the head, except in some areas, as you mentioned, green technology, very interesting one. I'd say cell phone technology actually is emerging as another interesting area of real interesting technology innovation.
I have an anecdote about Chinese innovativeness, which I'll use we've run out of questions. Yes, go ahead.
My question regards the ethics of the pull. As we look at vested interest groups around the globe, and particularly in America, our healthcare system and the intellectual property globally surrounding that, one innovative thought is that the countries that are the most successful in the healthcare world are the ones that pay the healthcare practitioners to keep their patients healthy. So the doctors who make the most money are the ones who keep their patients healthy. So as we look at the intellectual property and the vested interest groups in our country who profit by illness and catastrophic disease, what innovative pull can we tap into globally to solve that problem in America?
It's a great question, and I'm probably going to sound more like Marx than before. There are back to my roots. There are extraordinary entrenched interests in the world of pull. They will not relinquish power willingly, so it is going to be a struggle. I believe that the way the struggle will evolve is one of the key themes, and JSB mentioned it, our research center is called the Center for the Edge. We put a lot of emphasis on edges, and by that we mean peripheries where there are significant unmet needs and significant unexploited capabilities, and they tend to attract a lot of risk takers because they're really driven by, they see the potential to do some very challenging things in these edges. You can think about edges in geographic terms. We would view China and India as edges in a global economy. We would view the younger generation coming into the workforce and into the marketplace as another kind of edge, unaddressed needs, unexploited opportunities. We would view new generations of technology as edges. In the specific case of healthcare, I would argue, and one of my first startups was actually in the healthcare field, so I have some painful direct experience with the entrenched interests, that the edge that matters in healthcare is around the wellness movement. It is a growing concern on the part of more and more people. They are very frustrated in their ability to actually get their wellness needs addressed. The wellness providers are largely hugely fragmented. I think there's a tremendous opportunity to come in and help organize, aggregate those wellness providers for the segment of the population that really cares about wellness. And as you build critical mass around that, you will pull in more and more of the traditional healthcare providers who want to be part of this broader platform, pull platform. But I don't think... I welcome all those who are trying to go direct in and transform the healthcare providers directly. I frankly believe that the change, and this is another theme in the book, is if you're trying to get fundamental change, never, ever go after the core. The core is extraordinarily powerful, and they have antibodies that will kill you very quickly. So don't go to the core. Find an edge that can scale much more rapidly than ever before because of the technologies and management practices that are now available, and progressively pull more and more of the people and resources from the core out to these edges so that over time they become a new core. And by the way, by that time there'll be new edges forming that will pull on that core. But I think that's the answer. And
yes. I have a question about a softer industry, the entertainment industry. It is the number one trade positive benefit over aerospace for the United States. So it's pretty good news. It's still pretty good news. And there are a lot of reasons why that is, including patents and copyrights, including democracy and ability to free expression. But I'm interested how the push-pull would have any implication in the creation of art, which you could define as fine art, movies, television, yeah. IP, technology,
yeah.
Where the United States clearly is the products of the United States are still the most sought after by leaps and bounds of anywhere else.
Yes.
So I just thought I would ask that question just so we don't walk out the door and shoot ourselves. It still is an area that we do pretty well.
And you might explain the standing to speak of the questioner.
No, yeah. you can.
So, question from Michael Eisenberg. Yes. Go ahead.
Yes. Go ahead. Yeah. So, So the there are many answers to that. One answer is just again to go back to our shift index, because one of the challenges we got to the shift index was this is for the U.S. economy as a whole. Clearly, their industries differ dramatically in terms of their performance. Maybe this long-term decline in ROA is just one or two industries like the automobile industry pulling everything else down. We went out and took apart the data into 13 different industries. 11 out of the 13 industries have experienced this long-term erosion in ROA. Media and entertainment is one of them, actually. So they are under increasing pressure in terms of overall profitability for the industry. I would say that, to me, the big issue, opportunity and challenge for the entertainment business and the media business overall is this notion of the democratization of production capability, so that there's more and more options that are competing for the attention of the audience. And in that kind of environment, I do think that the unmet need is increasing return on attention. How do you connect the right kind of media and entertainment options that are increasingly available out there with the specific individuals who are going to find that particular artistic expression or creative expression the most valuable? And so I think there's a whole new opportunity in the media business for a set of intermediaries that become, in effect, trusted advisors to individual audience members to say, based on our understanding of your media and entertainment interests and needs, these are the kinds of things that are going to be most interesting and relevant to you. I think that that's still in the very earliest stages of development, but I do believe that over time, it forces, so I would say the media business in general, and this is a huge generalization, I apologize for making it, but I believe that most media and entertainment companies are in essence product companies. And they're deeply passionate about their products. They want more and more of the audience, the potential audience, to see their products. In that kind of environment, there is a missing entity who is somebody who takes the side of the audience and says, basically, we don't care who produced the content, who produced the media. We just want you to get the best media to meet your interests and needs. And I think that's a big opportunity.
In the same good news spirit as your question, I'll say that, as you probably know, American media are universal and dominant in China. Unfortunately, it's all the DVDs for 80 cents. And so it's a good news, bad news situation.
Avatar.
Yes.
Jack Hittery. John, my question's about this paradox or the struggle for innovation among the senior individuals at large corporations. So on the one hand, at least the folks I've met are passionate about innovation and wanting to really change things up. And they're at the senior-most level. One example, for example, is Hubert Berta, heads up Berta Media. He's so passionate about it and talking about the edge, he took money from his own pocket, started two companies inside the Berta family in Brooklyn, not in Munich, but in Brooklyn,
yes,
and pushed them way to the edge so they can have some entrepreneurial growth. And yet even those two little entities are finding that the big mothership is trying to suck them back in. So even when somebody has that kind of control that Hubert Berta has in that company, where he's actually the co-owner, and again, if you look at Tom Glocer at Reuters, if you look at just lots of these individuals who are massively innovative yet having trouble making this happen, how do you kind of reconcile that? And I guess also I just want to thank you, John, for the phrase, Jack Hitter exposes himself in the book, which has brought me a lot of interesting
This is
email.
A man yeah, we thanks. Wrote about in yeah. the book. If you want to understand how to attract, you need to talk to Jack. No, it's a great question. I think part of it has to do with choices of edges. Number one, in terms of edges that it can really have the potential to scale extremely rapidly, and a choice of the technologies and platforms that will help those edges to scale very, very rapidly. I'll give you a contrasting example that you know from the book, which is SAP, another German company. The guy who founded SAP was becoming increasingly concerned about the bureaucracy and the top-down and not-invented-here culture in SAP. He basically brought in a person from the outside, a guy that's become reasonably well-known by the name of Shai Agassi. And he said, he gave Shai an assignment. He said, I'm concerned about the core, but I'm not going to put you in the core because I know they're going to kill you. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to put you with a new product that we've just introduced called NetWeaver. It has zero sales, zero profitability, so nobody in the core is going to pay attention to this product. And I want you to develop a completely different way of connecting out to the broader software community using this product.
He started this thing called the Software Developer Network, which basically was an environment for software engineers from their customers and their partners to come in to this network and pose questions when they ran into programming problems. Long story short, that Software Developer Network now has over 2 million participants worldwide. It's still growing at a dramatic rate. And more of the SAP software engineers, those not invented here, dyed-in-the-wool SAPers, are getting pulled out to the Software Developer Network because the word is spread. If you've got productivity issues and problems in your programming, you got to go there.
So we've reached the end of our time. Before we thank John Hagel, we all, of course, feel much better because we're better informed now. But in terms, I want to do a brief poll on feeling better or worse about prospects for America. Who feels better about prospects for America now on the basis of what they've heard? Who feels more concerned? Well, both answers are good because concern is the motivation. Thanks very much to John Hagel.
I should mention, too, there will be a book signing out at the bookstore at 4 o'clock. So any of you who want to purchase the book.
John, thank you.